Our guest speaker this morning is a member of our congregation. Her name is Shannon Peterson, and she will discuss the challenges of living with mental illness through stories of people she has known during her 30-year career in mental health. Shannon has had leading roles at 6 public and private institutions, as well as many volunteer roles in the field of mental health. She currently supports over 100 patients in an independent housing program sponsored by the nonprofit called HOMES. And HOMES is an acronym for Helping Our Mentally Ill Experience Success. So let's all welcome Shannon Peterson.
Good morning. I've worked in the mental health field in Orange County for over 30 years. For the past 12 years, I've worked at HOMES Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization that provides affordable, supportive housing for adults with mental illness, including those who've been homeless. We currently house over 100 adults with mental illness and some with their children in 6 houses and 3 apartment buildings. According to the point-in-time count, a nationwide count of the homeless that's conducted every other year, in 2013, there was an estimated 12,000 people homeless in Orange County. The federal definition of homelessness means literally sleeping outdoors or in a vehicle, in a building not fit for human habitation, or in an emergency shelter. Those who are living in a motel, living in overcrowded or substandard housing, or couch surfing with family and friends are not considered homeless by HUD. I personally have known people who have slept in storage units, in garages, in laundry rooms, in camper shells, and in vacant buildings. It's estimated that a quarter of homeless individuals are mentally ill, a quarter are veterans, and almost half have substance abuse issues. There's overlap between these categories, and many homeless people do not fit any of them. For the purposes of today's presentation, I'll focus on people who are homeless and have mental illness. I've entitled today's presentation, Helping the Phoenix to Rise, in honor of those that I've known who've risen anew from the ashes of their previous lives. Many of the people who are homeless have lost literally everything, not only housing, but ties with their family and friends, jobs, income, health insurance, security, safety, and hope. Homeless individuals with mental illness have lost even more, their ability to trust their own emotions and thoughts and judgment. I am honored to have with me here today two people who have made the journey back from despair and desperation of mental illness and homelessness, and who have the courage and the generosity of spirit to share some of their stories with you. I've promised them they only need to speak briefly, but they're willing to answer questions at the conclusion of our presentation. Marty and Mary, if you can come up. Both Marty and Mary have been very involved in the camp that we do for mentally ill people once a year. We'll have our 10th camp next year.
Hello, I'm Marty, still. So it's a joy to hear Shannon speak. She's just so calm, and then you realize you want to try to emulate her, and you get up here, and your heart's beating like 9,000 miles a minute. And she's asked me to speak at a couple different functions. One was for the golf fundraiser. I speak for a crisis intervention class, and it's all. I always get really nervous, so that's why I started off with. I'm still Marty. I've actually been homeless. I was counting it in the seat there probably 4 times or 5 times. Not really to the extent that Shannon had mentioned, but at the most, a 2-week period. It would be in Orange County, Portland, and Hawaii, which is where I grew up. And I tell you 100% it's much better to be homeless in Hawaii. And not just because of the weather and whatnot, but it seemed like the people that were homeless in Hawaii were much more helping and generous to me and kind of took me under their wing. The people in Portland were very just rude. I didn't like them. And Orange County is a very, very great place. I wouldn't be here standing if I wasn't homeless in Orange County at one point. I had been homeless for, again, about 2 weeks. My sister heard about the HOMES program that Shannon works for and has worked for a few years before. And just a really quick backtrack. I was diagnosed bipolar 1 in 1983, fresh out of college, so I've been dealing with this for quite a while. So long story short, I'm homeless. I get the interview with Shannon and Helen to get into a home's house or a home's room. So I'm at the end of my rope. My parents have kicked me out again. I don't have any money. Completely desperate. I go through a very quick process of meeting at the house for an interview with the other roommates and a couple other applicants. I think I got fast-tracked in because Shannon, like, I don't know, had a crush on me or something. I'm not sure. No, I'm just kidding. But so I got in there really quick. I was severely depressed. That was back in 2003, 2004. And it's just been like a stepping stone. I mean, I've had real jobs in my life. I worked at a bank for 3 years. I worked at a reinsurance companies for 14 years, which was my career. And then in 2000, everything just whammoed. So I was very lucky to get involved with homes. I stayed there for 2.5 years, stepping stone to get my own place. I live in Huntington Beach now with a beautiful lady and two cats and a little, you know, small little cottage and three tortoises. So it's not where I wanted to be out of college. I'm not kidding, but considering all that and that I have two beautiful daughters, you know, I'm just blessed every day. So thank you. Oh, and Mary, the next person, I've known her for quite a number of years. And she's really funny. You'll enjoy her.
If you can see her.
Can you see me? Do I have to stand on the...
Is there a second?
There you go.
No?
Okay. That's it. Oh, they have a real... Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Thank you for this extra service. Oh, now I'm more nervous. Hi, my name is Mary. I'm a photographer. And I have 32 nephews and nieces. I lost my job after 26 years the same place. And I became homeless. And I had like a nervous breakdown and became mentally ill. I was hospitalized. I was... lived in shelters. I lived in my car. I met a world of people. I think my story is really quite mild compared to the many people I have met along the way who have been struggling in their lives. They inspire me and lift me up to be grateful and give gratitude for what I have and for the wonderful people I've met in my life. I have been involved in OASIS. They were a huge help to me. OASIS stands for an acronym for Older Adults Support and Intervention System. And they did that, literally, and they're still doing that with me. I had very little self-esteem left, no self-confidence, and extremely low trust quotient. And I'm been able to rebuild some of that, and I have become an ambassador at OASIS. And then I became the president of the ambassadors at OASIS. And then, more recently, I've been involved in the camp with Holmes. That's where I met Shannon and Marty. And there's such an opportunity for growth there. If you know anyone that might benefit from going there, please send them. We enjoy the company, and everyone is accepted equally. Anyway, Holmes recently... elected me as, I gotta get this title right, IEC committee, I am now on the board of the instigators Instigators Executive Planning Committee for Camp. This gives me a lot of pride and gratitude for other people who have helped me get there, because I never would have gotten here where I am today without them, and I can't believe I'm standing here up here in front of more than two people. It's quite shocking. I mean, you're all lovely to look at and see, and still, I appreciate your smiles, but it's really, really difficult for me. And I think I brought you a current date. Thank you.
As you heard from Marty and Mary, there are many agencies and programs in Orange County that are effective in helping homeless adults with mental illness to rebuild their lives. There's a multi-service center in Santa Ana that's open 365 days a year, where mentally ill homeless can take a shower, wash their clothes, use them as a mailing address, and be linked with multiple services to help them recover. Thanks to Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act, also called the Millionaire's Tax, there are many new full-service partnerships that offer wraparound services for mentally ill individuals who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, including transitional age youth between the ages of 18 and 25, and older adults. Members of this congregation are familiar with the cold weather shelter emergency, the cold weather shelter program at the Armories. And many of you may also be aware that the Fullerton City Council recently rejected an agreement to build a year-round shelter here in Fullerton. I felt close to despair on hearing that decision after the Kelly Thomas incident. If we didn't build it then, I fear that we never will build it here, and I think it's really sad. In the affordable housing business, the sardonic new term for NIMBYism, NIMBY is not in my backyard, is banana, which is build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. I want to tell the story of Brian. Before Brian came to live at Holmes, he lived homeless on the streets of San Diego for many years. He was raised in Orange County, but in his late teens, he began to hear voices and have disordered thinking, and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was hospitalized many times, and at one point, he walked to San Diego because he felt that God was calling him there. I had a picture of his ID card from 1999, and I don't know that we're going to be able to show it. The ID card shows him with long hair, long beard, but what's really significant is the look on his face. His eyes are just empty. They're dead. There's no life. There's no hope. There's no expression on his face. It's a very dramatic picture of Brian before, during his last and longest period of homelessness. Brian lost contact with family and friends, but eventually he walked back to Orange County and was placed into a licensed board and care home, where his medication was administered to him by the staff and his meals were prepared for him. When he became stable from this environment, he moved into a Holmes house where he lived for 10 years. One of the requirements for living at Holmes is participation in structured activity outside the house 20 hours each week or more. The activity can be any combination of employment, volunteering, going to school, job training, attendance at religious services, 12-step meetings, any kind of program or activity that gets people on a schedule and being productive and being out and around other people. Brian more than met this requirement. He joined a church and eventually participated in their men's group and their choir. He returned to school, taking general ed and computer science classes at Santiago Canyon College. He developed significant computer skills and became a volunteer IT intern at college. He also took a mental health paraprofessional course, and after completion, he got a job mentoring other adults with mental illness. And here, I was going to show a picture of Brian in his cap and gown, neatly shaven, smiling, receiving his diploma from St. Anna Canyon College. Would have been dramatic had you seen it. Brian never complained, but in 2009, it became clear that he was physically ill. He became jaundiced, and he admitted that he'd had abdominal pain for some time. It was discovered that he had liver cancer, and he died less than 2 months after that diagnosis. During his last hospitalization, Brian was visited by literally dozens of people from school, work, homes, and church. Every time I went to the hospital to see him, he had people with him, and as I left, there were new people arriving. He had two friends by his side when he died. Although I was unable to locate his biological family before his death, he had many people that he referred to as kin. I still miss him, but this is not actually a sad ending. Brian could have died alone on the streets of San Diego, unknown and unmourned. But with treatment and support, he is able to graduate from college, become employed, and develop a large and loving circle of friends. A true phoenix, Brian rose from the ashes of his previous life, destroyed by mental illness and homelessness, and built a new, productive, and fulfilling life. Thank you for allowing Marty, Mary, and I to speak to you this morning. We're available for any questions that you might have. Come back up. Yeah. Does anybody have any questions for us now? Yes.
Hi, Bill. How are, I know driving to work the other day, I heard on the news that Anaheim is now not letting any homeless person sleep in parks or in public places. How is that affecting the cities and services around?
I think the rule is not that they can't sleep there, but that they can't have their stuff with them. It's an anti-camping ordinance, so they can't have their belongings with them, is what the new law that they're enforcing is. Yeah, exactly. And as far as how it affects the other cities, many homeless people will tell you, one of my clients used to live in his car, and he had all of his possessions in his car. And if the police found him sleeping in his car, they would make him remove everything from his car so they could look through it, and they'd leave it out of the car. And it was basically just harassment to make it not comfortable for him to be wherever he was. I know other people who are sleeping literally under the bushes, and the police will come and tell them that they can't be there, and their question is, where am I supposed to go, and how am I supposed to get there? The buses don't run in the middle of the night. And the answer is, I don't know, but you can't be here. So anytime one city enacts ordinances or pulls back services, it moves people around and makes life more miserable for them. I call it the misery index.
I hear a lot about medications to help the emotionally disturbed. Number one, do they work? And can these people that you're talking about, are there channels where they can get these medications?
Okay. The answer is usually they work, and usually they work with side effects. So most of the people that live at homes are taking medications, and most of them are experiencing side effects of one kind or another. I don't know if either one of you want to talk about medication-related stuff at all.
Medications have worked for me. There are side effects. It's not uncommon for people who are taking psych meds to gain weight, and I did. I gained 40 pounds, but I'm unhappy with that, and I struggle with that. But I'm a much happier person, and you wouldn't like me very much if I wasn't on my medication.
I just want to add to that. So being diagnosed in 83, I've been through, I counted them one time, like over 30 medications. And at some point, I've been like so overdosed by the doctors. I was on 9 different medications, and maybe a third of those were to treat the side effects of the ones that were supposed to be helping me, that were making me really tired and grouchy. So I have a very good, they call it a cocktail. I have, some others, sometimes physical issues that may or may not be related to it. Stress is always something I try to avoid. But for me, my medications have been working very well for 10 years, the last 10 years. So that's kind of the answer to your question, I hope.
Yes. He's trying to avoid stress, so I brought him up here speaking in public. The other thing about medication, people who take psychiatric medication double their risk of getting diabetes, and that's whether or not there's weight gain. So in the mainstream population, 1 in 10 people has type 2 diabetes. In the mental health population, it's 1 in 5. So I do a couple of diabetes support groups for people who take medication and who live in our houses. I have diabetes myself, so I have some knowledge of that. You asked a question about affordability of medication. It depends on the health coverage. People who have Medi-Cal or Medicare, which most of our residents do, pays for most of the medication. There may be a share of cost. For people that don't have any kind of coverage at all, There is medical services for the indigent program that the county runs, where they can get medication, and some of them also make it pharmacy assistance programs directly from the pharmaceutical companies so that their medications cost less. But it's still a significant cost to people. People living on SSI get $850 a month to live on. That has to pay for everything. It has to pay for their housing, for their clothing, for their food, for their transportation, for their medication, their co-pays for their doctor, all that. So it's a challenge.
For those that need these services, how difficult is it for them to get them?
That's an it depends question. For people who are willing to get services, there are a number of different places they can receive services. The county at this point, I worked for county behavioral health services for 16 years before I fled. Now I refer to myself as a recovering county employee. Not to put them down, they definitely fill a need, but there are some challenges with the system. So if people have no other resources, if they can't get care through the private sector, don't have private health insurance, they can get care through the county as long as they have a serious and persistent mental illness, which is a certain level of severity and medical necessity. And also they need to, because of that illness, be having some kind of difficulty functioning and taking care of daily life. So if somebody is homeless, if somebody needs help applying for benefits, if they have some kind of social services kind of need in addition to the mental illness, they can get services through the county. I also mentioned the full-service partnerships, and those are county contracted programs that are paid for with Prop 63 funds for people who, for whatever reason, have not been able to link with county services. Either they don't want to or it just doesn't work for them for some reason. They can go to the full-service partnerships. The OASIS program that Mary mentioned is one of the full-service partnerships. And they provide wraparound services. So in addition to a psychiatrist and medication, they also get, they could be called a case manager, a personal services coordinator. There's all kinds of names for them. But basically, it's a person who will help them solve whatever problems they have and work towards whatever goals they have. So there are those services available. One of the larger challenges with mental illness for people who have very severe mental illness is they don't recognize that they have an illness. So there are people who are quite ill. They have hallucinations, they have delusions, they have paranoia, they have serious mental illness, and don't recognize that it's an illness. It's a brain illness, so if your brain is the part of your body that's injured or impaired, your judgment is affected. So if they don't recognize that they have an illness, they're probably not going to seek treatment, they're probably not going to be willing to have treatment. I don't want to take a stand one way or the other on Laura's Law, but Laura's Law is something that can compel people into involuntary outpatient treatment if they meet certain criteria. So their treatment is overseen by a court and a judge, and they're required to take medication, they're required to keep appointments, they may be required to live in a certain place. So that's one possible alternative. It has not been fully enacted in Orange County. There is no funding for it with the law, for one thing. There are some civil rights questions about people being compelled into involuntary treatment. As we said, the medications have some serious side effects. Even good ones, even ones that are working, they have some serious side effects, and some people don't want to take meds as a result.
Can you give a brief summary of how the Affordable Care Act is helping or not helping others who are mentally ill?
Nothing has actually happened yet, except people who are up to the age of 26 can be covered on their parents' insurance. So the rest of it hasn't happened yet. And the honest answer is, I don't know what's going to happen. I've attended, I can't tell you how many workshops on what's supposed to happen. And I still don't have a clear idea of, on January 1st, what is going to be different for our clients. I know the medical services for the indigent program that I mentioned for people who don't have any other coverage, it's a county program that's going to go away as of January 1st and is supposed to be covered through ACA. I don't know how that's going to happen. I attended a workshop last week, and people were not quite sure. People who work for CalOptima, which is the agency in Orange County that administers Medi-Cal, said that they have heard that dental and optical services are going to be returned for people with Medi-Cal. A couple years back, they stopped paying for dental work. So if somebody has an abscess tooth, they now go to the emergency room instead of seeing the dentist, which is not a cost-saving measure. It was a stupid thing to do. But they've heard that there may be dental and optical coverage, but they don't know. And that's the agency that's going to administer it in 2 months. So that's my answer. I don't know what's going to happen.
Shannon, churches are not often not set up to be social service agencies. What's the main role that churches can do or are doing that you see with your clients?
That's a great question. We have one church, one of the founders of Home in 1985. Homes was founded by family members who had loved ones with mental illness. And there was nothing in between a board and care, which offers 24-hour care and supervision. They do everything for you. They wash your clothes, they cook your meals, they clean. And if you weren't in a board and care, you were living alone in an apartment with no support whatsoever. And there's nothing in between those two things, and people tended to leave the board and care, go into an apartment, deteriorate, go back into a board and care at the hospital, and then a board and care, and kind of bounce around a lot. So one of the founders of Homes in 1985 belongs to a Presbyterian church in Santa Ana who's been a champion of Homes since the beginning. One of the most important things that a congregation can do is to have congregants who are aware of mental illness and who welcome mentally ill people into their congregation. That's the simplest, easiest thing. There are, unfortunately, churches where my clients don't feel comfortable. There aren't as many churches anymore who are saying that they're possessed by demons and that they need to be prayed over and not take medication. That doesn't happen so much anymore, although it has happened to some of our clients.
Trinity Church, there's a particular commissioner name. Ramona?
Sure.
Yeah. I know Ramona Snyder, and evidently it was her brother that had mental illness. And when I mentioned my story about Homes and that my sister had known about it a few years before that, my sister actually went to Trinity Church. She lived down the street from there and knew Shannon or Ramona Snyder and heard about the Homes program and tried to introduce it to me. I wasn't ready. It just happened, you know, it just fell into place finally for me. I've been an avid volunteer with anything that I'm asked for the church. I've done volunteer yard work for different people that go to that church. And just anything that they want help with, I'll help them. I wanted to ask a question. I usually ask this question. How many people here, besides knowing us two now, know either homeless or mentally ill person? Okay, and then how many people, when you look in the mirror, are counting that person as being mentally ill? No one ever raises their hand. It's great.
No one counts to it.
No one counts to it. Maybe after. Okay.
Okay, some of the other things that churches have done that are really helpful to our organization is they have given food baskets at the holidays. As I mentioned, a lot of our clients don't have contact with their families anymore, so they have holiday dinners together. And it's nice to have that supported by the church. Trinity also has, they host support groups, like NAMI support groups. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I'm a member of the state board, the California state board for NAMI. And they provide free education, support, and advocacy to people with mental illness and their families. So it's helpful if churches can host either a support group or an education course. But the main thing is being inclusive, raising awareness of mental illness and mental health and recovery, having conversations about it, having presentations like this, thank you, and making our clients feel welcome. Social isolation is one of the hardest parts of being mentally ill. After your symptoms are treated, you kind of have to build a life again. And if you've lost contact with family and friends, being part of a congregation is a big deal.
If someone recognizes that he needs help, and for various reasons, he or she is in a place that doesn't, what would be the first thing, the most useful thing for that person to do in a strange community? Find one of the agencies that you described, but how would someone ever know what they were and where them?
That's a good question, too. The county has several numbers that they quote as the portal of entry where people can call, but there's several different ones, which is really confusing. The simplest thing to tell people is to call 211. 211 is social services information. 411 gives you general information and phone numbers. 211 can give you information about homeless shelters or counseling programs or domestic violence programs or whatever social services you're looking for. So the easiest thing that I tell people is to call 211.
Hello, I'm Jim, And it's my understanding that many mentally ill people and people who are homeless self-medicate, other than the medication they can receive from a physician, or without, they're just, that's their only medication. And it can range from alcohol to methamphetamines to marijuana. My understanding and my experience is that some of those can be extremely harmful, especially alcohol, heroin, methamphetamine, you know, all those real hard things. But marijuana seems to be on the fence more. And so how does that play in from your perspective to the mentally ill situation, marijuana?
Okay. One of the things that makes medication in general challenging is everybody's body reacts differently. It's not just allergies. It's people may have exactly the same symptoms, and a certain medication will work well for one and will not work at all for the other. So it's a challenge to find medications that work appropriately. Marty mentioned that he's tried 30 different ones, and that's why. With marijuana, people react differently to that, too. I know some people who've had a good effect from marijuana, and they have a medical marijuana card now. We have a couple in our houses where it calms them, it soothes them, it helps them think more clearly because they're not anxious or paranoid or whatever it is. I know other people who smoke pot and get very paranoid. They become psychotic from smoking pot. So, again, it's a matter of how it affects the individual person. The self-medication issue is always tricky because mental illness, depending on the illness, tends to strike between the ages of like 17 and 24. And that's also the time when many people are experimenting with different substances. So it's hard to tell kind of which came first. I do know some people with methamphetamine especially that had no mental health symptoms before they started using it, and they stay psychotic even after they stop. So that to me is a particularly dangerous one. I don't think, in general, substances cause mental illness. I think it's a biochemical illness that you're predisposed to, and certain things can trigger it, including stress. Like people moving away to college for the first time is often a time when it strikes. So I don't think it causes it, but it is a complication. Physically, people who abuse substances, whether they have a mental illness or not, it's not a physically healthy thing to do. And our clients, the people who have mental illness, die on average 25 years younger than the general population. And part of it is because they haven't taken care of themselves well. They're poor, and they're not thinking clearly when they're not well. Part of it is, I believe, related to taking medication. It's hard on your body to take 9 different medications at the same time. So the substances just increase that number of years that they're going to die early if they're abusing it.
What responsibility do we as individuals have? Like, for example, if we saw Kelly Thomas at the Fullerton train station, should we get on the phone and call 211? Or are these people under some kind of consciousness of the institutions around that provide support? What is our personal role?
I struggle with that all the time, and I'm in the field. I'm aware that when I see a homeless cat, I bring the cat home with me, and I know very well there's human beings sleeping in the park near my house. You know, so I struggle with that issue also. There are people who are newly homeless or newly ill who don't know the resources, and if they were given the resources, they might be able to get help sooner rather than later. There are other people who have been around a little bit longer and may have had really bad experiences. The reason I didn't want to take a stand on Laura's Law is because people have had some very traumatic experiences in hospitals. People are having good intentions and wanting to help, but if you can imagine yourself being strapped down and injected with something that makes your muscles cramp to the point that you think your bones are going to break, that's happened to people. So they may not want to go to the resources that are available. So my suggestion is to have dialogue and conversation when you can, just starting with general conversation. Many people who are homeless tell me that they feel like they're invisible because nobody will make eye contact with them. Nobody wants to speak to them. They're afraid. Afraid not only of violence, but what do you say? You know, how do you make conversation? Well, it's like making conversation with anybody else. My mother talks to people in the grocery store line all the time. So to have a conversation and kind of get to know a person and see where they might be. If they don't know resources, it would be awesome to give them to them. If they know resources and don't want to go, that's a different problem. my personal threshold. If somebody is doing something that I think is likely to harm them physically, when somebody is stepping into traffic, when somebody looks like they haven't eaten and they're weak and debilitated physically. I had one gentleman who used to stare up at the sun, and he is blind now. And we called about him because he's harming himself physically in the moment. So that personally for me, that's my threshold for doing something, whether someone is in that moment willing or not. It's a difficult problem.